This is Sierra Dahl with Municipal Sustainability and Energy Forum, and today I'll be your host for the conference call. We have Baird Brown at Eco and Law and Greg Lewis from Clean Coalition, who are going to be discussing how to measure and reward resilience in the role of the microgrid tariff. So, Baird, why don't you go ahead and start us out, and then Craig, I think maybe just join in whenever you feel like it.
Okay. Thanks, Sierra, for inviting me here. I'm looking forward to this. For those who don't know, I, among other things, represent the Microgrid Resources Coalition, which is an advocacy group for microgrids. And starting in connection with Hawaii microgrid proceeding earlier in this year, and then continuing in connection with thinking about the California legislation, and then also at some length in our involvement in the MedSys proceeding in the District of Columbia, we've been kind of refining our thoughts about what a microgrid tariff might look like. And in a way, it's pretty simple. So I'll get to the resilience payments in a minute, but just the microgrid needs to be treated as a resource in the system. And for most purposes, that means being treated as a hybrid resource that has all the capabilities that result from all the different things, whether that's solar or batteries or cogen or whatever is behind the meter that they have to operate with, or literally demand response from buildings and so forth, or industrial processes. So all of those together should be treated as the resource, and the interconnection process should do that and do it once and for all, unless there's a dramatic increase in exports. It shouldn't be every time you jigger with something behind the meter, there's a need for a new interconnection. And the, you know, whatever services the microgrid's going to provide to the grid, it needs to have the necessary interconnection and communication capabilities in order to provide those services, but that shouldn't be different than any other resource that serves the grid. And similarly, microgrids, treated as a collective resource, should be able to provide any service where there are grids that operate markets, such as in the RTOs. You know, the microgrid should be able to perform any service that any other resource can perform, that it, you know, is technically capable of performing. So just establishing those things in the tariff, mostly that microgrids get treated whole and get treated like any other resource as a whole, is the important first step. And then the remaining step, a next step is, well, are we going to pay the microgrid anything special that's different than any other resource that provides any other defined service, whether to an RTO market or to an independent utility that's not within an RTO? And there are, broadly speaking, we think, two kinds of payments that one might consider. One is a feed-in tariff-type payment for simply being a qualified microgrid. And if one were to do that, that's saying we see the grid of the future. The grid of the future needs more microgrids for resilience, and the grid operator of the future is going to be able to mix and match and manage the grid in a more cellular way, more the way internet bundles work than the way the grid works now. And so more microgrids is just a good thing and we should support them. And, you know, you could apply a variety of limitations or requirements on that, including minimum islanding duration, or maybe different tiers, a designation of the resource as a resilience resource, you know, as serving critical local facilities that we think should come, if it comes from the state emergency managing process and management process, along with local community input, not trying to assign to the PUC the job of deciding what's a critical resource for a community. And then, you know, other things have been suggested, such as a credit for vulnerable areas such as fire risk zones in California or energy justice areas, where to assure that microgrid services come to low-income areas as well as to folks who can afford to put them up for themselves. The second kind of payment to be considered would be one that's actually a payment for services that would be a pro forma category of service that only a microgrid could provide. And that would be that it would island for some specific number of hours at the, you know, hours in a year at the grid operator direction. So it's it's sort of like demand response, but it's taking yourself entirely off the grid and being ready to come back on when the grid operator says come back on, and giving the grid operator that control and making a payment for that basic microgrid service. We also strongly encourage distribution utilities to think about other services microgrids could provide, and since they're very flexible resources typically, and to pay for that. I'll stop there. I mean, we've thought a bunch about other things like consumer protection and utility participation and things like that, but I'll turn the floor over.
All right, okay. Craig, do you have any comments there? Go ahead.
Yeah, Sierra, I'll just take about 5 minutes like Bear did, unless you want to do any Q&A there for Bear.
No, please, you know, whatever, just make it free flow. Talk as long as you want. And Baird, if you have a question, chime in.
Okay. So this is Craig Lewis with the Clean Coalition, and I am the founder and executive director of the Clean Coalition. We are a nonprofit organization focused on the accelerating the transition to renewable energy and a modern grid. We do a lot of work in the world of microgrids and what we call community microgrids. And the difference there for us is a microgrid is serving a single metered customer, and a community microgrid is incorporating a broader grid area, generally, you know, served along a shared feeder, an electric feeder, or potentially all the way up to a distribution substation. But any grid area served by a common substation is electrically connected through the feeders that are all served by that substation. So the key there on a community microgrid is to have electrical connectivity. In terms of resilience, the Clean Coalition thinks about resilience in terms of being able to keep the electricity flowing, particularly for your most important loads. And we have the Clean Coalition has an initiative called Value of Resilience 1-2-3. And this is a initiative that we envisioned a couple years ago, but we have yet to get any real funding for it. So it is kind of beg, borrowing, and stealing to make progress on this particular VOR 1-2-3, Value of Resilience 1-2-3 initiative. But the name has a pretty significant meaning to the way the Clean Coalition views resilience, and so I'll explain it. The Clean Coalition's view of energy resilience is essentially to keep your most important loads operational indefinitely and to do that through renewables-driven backup power. The only way you can keep any electric load operational indefinitely is through renewables. You can't have a diesel storage tank big enough to claim that you're going to keep a load on indefinitely. But when it comes to solar, for example, if you can see outside, even if it's raining and stormy and cloudy and smoky and whatever else, if you can see, there are photons hitting solar panels, and there is some level of generation happening in that solar facility. So you can actually design a microgrid and a community microgrid to provide indefinite renewables-driven backup power to whatever level of load that you need. So that brings us to the question of, well, what level of load do you need to back up indefinitely? And the answer to that for the Clean Coalition is you need to be able to back up your most critical, we call them tier one loads. These are your mission critical, life-sustaining loads. Generally speaking, these are going to be about 10% of your normal loads. And whether you're talking about a fire station or you're talking about an entire grid area, these are going to be the most important loads that are at the fire station, at the hospital, at the emergency shelter, at the critical communications and water infrastructure facilities, et cetera. So when you think about your loads overall, you want to tier them into Tier 1, your most critical. Tier 2, your priority. So those are loads that you will keep on if you can do so without jeopardizing your ability to keep your Tier 1 loads on. And then there's Tier 3, which is everything else. Totally discretionary. You're probably not going to pay more for keeping Tier 3 loads on than you would normally pay for energy, right? They're totally discretionary loads. So the value of resilience 1-2-3 initiative is basically to utilize renewable energy combined with energy storage and load shedding strategies to ensure that you can keep your tier one most critical loads on indefinitely, and then to keep your tier twos on as much as you can, and then to keep your tier threes on, as energy is available. The in terms of how do you value resilience for these various these three tiers? The value is obviously different. If you are going to have loads that are mission critical, life sustaining, like at the fire station, it's going to be the dispatch is your most important load. You're going to keep that on, as your very most critical load. The value for the ability to keep those tier one loads on is 100 times, two orders of magnitude more than you would normally pay for electricity. You could say that there's, it's priceless, right? Your ability to keep your tier one loads on indefinitely is priceless. Your tier two loads, you're going to pay some premium. You're going to be willing to pay some premium to keep your tier twos on, but you're not going to pay the same amount that you would pay to keep your tier ones on. And then your tier threes on, like I said earlier, you're probably not going to pay a whole lot more than you would normally pay for energy. So the Baird brought up some ideas in terms of how do you actually go valuing these valuing resilience. And you have to do it differently for each one of those tiers, or you're going to come up with a different value for each one of those tiers, as I said. And the Clean Coalition believes that the preferred method to valuing resilience is a cost of service methodology, and Baird mentioned that. Cost of service is the normal approach for how the utility industry comes up with how much it's going to charge ratepayers for everything it does. It's based on cost of service, and that cost of service basically determines how much money has to be spent to put the the proper infrastructure in place to provide the service it's providing, and then to come up with a fair rate of return, and then come up with a revenue requirement, which then gets distributed across all the kilowatt hours that get delivered to everybody, and you know, parses into demand charges and other things. But essentially, it's what shows up on the ratepayer's bill is the amount that's required to meet the cost of service for utilities to deliver energy and whatnot. So we think that cost of service is the correct approach, and that means cost of service. Another way to think about cost of service is it's a market-based approach. When you are willing to pay the cost of service, it means that you're going to have market players that are willing to bring the solutions required to provide that service. So if you want to have indefinite renewables-driven backup power to your critical loads, then you need to have a price that is paid that's going to allow developers of microgrids to actually deploy solar and storage and other solutions that will be able to deliver on that. And those, if the price that's willing to be paid does not meet the cost of service threshold, guess what? There's not going to be much of it deployed. So if you actually want some of this deployed, you have to meet the cost of service threshold. And at the end of the day, the Clean Coalition believes that delivering indefinite renewables-driven backup power to critical loads is extraordinarily important, and I think we're reminded of that every day, because every day brings a new disaster somewhere around the country. And each disaster is a really glaring reminder we need to have energy resilience for our critical loads. So cost of service is really the approach that the Clean Coalition believes is the right one. And I like that Baird mentioned the term feed-in tariff, because at the end of the day, you can turn these, you can basically translate cost of service into a feed-in tariff mechanism. The Clean Coalition is working on one that we're designing that's called Dispatchable Energy Capacity Services, DECS, or DEX, as we pronounce it. And that is essentially a cost of service based approach for making sure that we can get energy storage deployed, and energy storage is a vital ingredient to bringing indefinite renewables driven backup power to critical loads. There are two other approaches I'll mention, and then I will let us get into moderated discussion, however you want to take it, Sierra. In addition to cost of service based approach, there is the avoided cost based approach. So if you say, okay, well, how is energy resilience provided today? It's generally provided through a diesel generator. So okay, well, what's the cost of a diesel generator? And when you think about this, you have to be very careful, because a diesel generator generally has 2 days of fuel supply on hand. So while you can keep your critical loads online, and maybe one would argue that diesel generators are sized to keep, you know, more of the tier one and tier two loads on, so both the critical and the priority loads, that's fine. Let's just say a diesel generator is designed to keep 100% of the load on, so tier one, two, and all the discretionary loads as well. It still only has, on average, 2 days of fuel supply. So if you have a major disaster that strikes, whether it's a fire, earthquake, hurricane, terrorist attack, you know, public safety power shutoff, which is just kind of a, you know, it's a high risk, you know, wildfire day, and the utility decides to turn off a big transmission line. It doesn't, for whatever reason, if you have a long-term electricity outage, then you may very well go beyond 2 days. And so as soon as that diesel fuels out, you're done, right? Then it's lights out. So importantly, right, the avoided cost approach, you need to say, well, what's it actually going to cost to give me indefinite, you know, backup power here? It's going to cost you a lot if you use a diesel approach. You're going to have a massive fuel tank. And, you know, diesel has some pretty significant costs going well beyond just the upfront costs of the equipment and installing it. There are ongoing operational costs. There are environmental limitations on how much you can actually run a diesel generator. All these things need to be considered, but the avoided cost approach would basically look at, you know, what other approach, you know, what other solution set could you bring to bring that kind of, you know, indefinite renewables driven resilience to those critical loads. So there's the cost of service approach, there's the avoided cost approach, and then there's the insurance-based approach. And the insurance-based approach is basically what would it cost, what would an insurer charge for the disaster that will happen if those critical loads go down? And that's how insurance is priced. A premium is based on, okay, if there's a claim or a set of claims, how much money is the insurer going to be, you know, on the hook to pay out? And then we need to make sure bake in our profit and bake in what the premium is going to be to everybody who's going to buy this type of insurance. So that's the third approach that the Clean Coalition has identified as one that would be a valid approach to look at and assess to see, you know, what the value of resilience is. But out of those three, cost of service, avoided cost, and insurance-based, the Clean Coalition believes that the right one is cost of service, and that's the one that will allow market mechanisms to get designed and implemented to actually get these renewables-driven resilient solutions implemented as soon as possible.
So this all is right, Baird. If I can have the privilege of the first question.
No, Baird. Just a second here. I want to have you have enough time to talk, and then after you're done, we'll go ahead and open it up to other questions. So go ahead.
So, Craig, I'm just curious to have you frame out what you mean by cost of service a little bit more. Presumably, the equipment that you install to create a microgrid, whether you, whatever you allow behind the meter, has other uses. If you've installed solar panels, they're going to be operating all the time, not just in an emergency. So how are you thinking about which part of the service needs to get covered? And then the second part of the question is, so how do you introduce any competition into determining what that cost might be? And how does everybody, is this functioning through the utility and everybody gets a microgrid, or is this market driven outside of the utility procurement?
Great questions, Baird. And I'll say that, you know, ideally this is available to all facilities, because, you know, who's to say that, you know, a particular company, you know, could have a data data center that they consider to be, you know, absolutely critical from a societal standpoint, right? The rest of society might not consider it to be critical, but that particular business might, and also a particular homeowner may have, a need that they consider to be absolutely critical, you know, beyond just, you know, keeping their food fresh. Somebody might have a piece of medical equipment that, you know, does, you know, is life sustaining, and if that goes down, somebody might die. So I would consider that critical. I would consider a refrigerator critical in certain instances, but certainly a priority. But in any case, given that you know, there are, you know, every facility is going to make its own decision as in terms of how they split up, you know, tier one, tier two, and tier three loads. And a lot of places aren't going to have a tier one load. You know, my house, for example, yeah, I'd like to keep my refrigerator on in a grid outage, but, you know, it's not absolutely critical. I'm not thinking that people are going to die if my refrigerator goes out. So the now I better have some other plan, right? If I, we're 5 days without electricity, you know, we're going to need some dry food, something that doesn't need to be refrigerated to sustain us. But I think you get my point. The beautiful thing about tiering the loads, by the way, is that you normalize between different types of facilities. So a hospital might say, well, 50% of our loads are tier one, critical, life-sustaining, and a fire station might say, well, only 10% are tier ones, right? But the tier one value is exactly the same for each facility. It is, you know, it is priced because it's critical, life-sustaining. Tier twos have the same price across, normalized across types of facilities. And tier threes, you know, similarly. The only difference is what percentage of the loads break down into tier one, tier two, tier three at the various types of facilities. And that's up for each facility to determine. Your question was a really good one, and I know I got a little bit off track, so I want to come back to it. But the and I kind of lost track of it. Baird, could you just jog my memory?
Well, the fact that we're installing equipment that has many uses, it will serve during normal hours as well as emergencies, and may even be used to provide services to the grid. And so
thanks for jogging my memory. So that's great, and that's exactly the way that the Clean Coalition thinks about it as well, is that the renewable energy resource, and by the way, the Clean Coalition is completely agnostic whether something is front of meter or behind the meter. You have to come up with different market mechanisms, you know, potentially, or tweak the market mechanisms depending on which side of the meter you're on. But if you take a look at our dispatchable energy capacity services market mechanism, essentially the very first implementation of that is in the feed-in tariff that the Clean Coalition designed for the City of San Diego, and we're getting close to publicly announcing that feed-in tariff. But we did include it. A reference to it and a link to the actual design in a recent filing to the California Public Utilities Commission to allow for DEX type services to critical community facilities, and so I've got a link to it that Sierra, I can share with you and you can share with folks if people want to see that feed-in tariff design. But it includes that feed-in tariff design includes a couple things that Baird mentioned. One, it includes a dispatchability adder, which is essentially the first implementation of a DEX mechanism, a dispatchable energy capacity services mechanism. And it's a capacity payment for energy storage, energy capacity, for the number of kilowatt hours that are being allocated under a capacity contract for daily cycling. So what has to be provided under that dispatchability adder is a guarantee to cycle a certain number of kilowatt hours per day out of a energy storage device, which, you know, presumably will normally be a lithium ion battery. And that capacity that's reserved for that daily cycling is obviously has a capital expenditure element. It has an operational expenditure element. So CapEx being capital expenditures, OpEx being operational expenditures. Those are you know, really critical pieces of making sure that the DEX, the Dispatchable Energy Capacity Services market mechanism, recoups the CapEx and the OpEx. People might wonder, CapEx is obvious. It's the cost of the battery installing it. What's OpEx? OpEx is the round-trip inefficiency of energy going in and out of the battery. OpEx is the need to, you know, operate the battery and replace parts if something goes wrong, or if it just comes to end of life. So our feed-in tariff for City of San Diego is a 20-year contract. Batteries, you know, lithium-ion batteries are expected to last somewhere between 10 and 15 years, right? So there's going to be a full, cell replacement over a 20-year time frame. So that's part of the OPEX. The insurance of just insuring this whole, you know, operation, if, you know, somebody gets electrocuted, right, you want to make sure the system is insured. So there are operational costs of keeping the system operational. So under the FINA tariff for San Diego, you essentially have the first implementation of a DEX. And by the way, Baird, in order to make sure that it matches with, you know, the market and if folks can put batteries in more efficiently than others, which some people are going to be more efficient at that than others, it has what's called a market pricing, market responsive pricing mechanism, which means that for each tranche of the feed-in tariff program allocation, if you get over participation, like there's a lot more folks who want to bring, you know, battery capacity into play than was expected, then the price of DEX would ratchet down for the next tranche. Once you are contracted, your contract's, you know, that price is fixed for 20 years, but each tranche can move around with market response. And so this this dispatchability adder for the San Diego feed-in tariff is the first example of this dispatchable energy capacity services market mechanism. Be happy to let people, you know, take a look at that. The one element for a generic dispatchable energy capacity services market mechanism is that you also have to, in addition to the CapEx and the OpEx, you also have to incorporate your net cost of electricity. And this is important because, as I said, the Clean Coalition is agnostic whether you're front of meter or behind the meter. The cost of electricity is different, you know, depending on which side of the meter you're on, and depending on whether you're able to, if you're front of meter, depending on whether you're able to procure your electricity at wholesale or whether you're having to pay retail, right? There's going to be a big price difference there. And then, of course, what you're able to sell it for when you discharge out of the battery. So the net cost of electricity incorporates, you know, how much is the electricity cost just to have energy going in and out of your battery. In the case of a feed-in tariff, the energy, the net cost of electricity is zero because the energy value that you're putting, you know, for electricity going into the battery is essentially the feed-in tariff value. And the energy value that comes out of the battery is also the feed-in tariff value. So you're the feed-in tariff value that's paid for the renewable energy resource. And so your net cost of electricity in the case of the dispatchability adder for the San Diego feed-in tariff is zero, and all you have to look at is CapEx and OpEx. Just to touch on one other element of your question, Baird, you know, where do you go to bring these microgrids and community microgrids into play? The Clean Coalition believes that the starting point is at your critical community facilities. These are your facilities that you know, no one would argue with, that these are facilities that serve the entire community. These are your hospitals, fire stations, emergency shelters, critical water communications infrastructure, et cetera, right? There's no argument that those types of facilities serve everybody. They serve the entire community, rich or poor. Doesn't matter, you know, which side of the tracks you're on. Doesn't matter, you know, whatever your demographic, you know, those facilities are there for the entire community. So we believe that those are those critical community facilities are the right ones to begin with. And you call it kind of the pilot rollout. And then as everybody sees how effective having indefinite renewables driven backup power is, then it can roll out to more and more market segments.
I would like to invite one more person into the conversation who is deeply into microgrids. Sean, are you there? Sean Flank?
Yes, I am here, Sierra.
Yes, why don't you go ahead and join the conversation if you have some questions or comments.
Sure. Craig, I particularly appreciate that you have kind of multiple approaches for pricing. You included the insurance, the kind of replacement cost or cost avoidance approach. And I particularly wanted to emphasize those because they provide a kind of shadow price for this. Since we don't really have functioning markets, it's hard to determine what's the right price to pay. I mean, you could say to the firehouse, how much would you be willing to pay for this? Or say to the city hall, how much would you be willing to have the firehouse pay? But without a price setting mechanism, that's kind of operating in a vacuum. So the idea of cost avoidance, well, how else would you get this functionality and what would it cost you? Or even better, what else would it cost? How else could you get this functionality? And in comparable cases, people have actually made that expenditure, so they've proven that it's worth it to them. And a similar idea for the insurance. So I was just wondering if we have access to, you know, empirical data that will help us with that, I'll call it a shadow pricing exercise.
Well, this is Baird. I think maybe I can clarify, and then Craig can tell me if I'm wrong, because I've had a chance to see their draft tariff for San Diego. I think what you're suggesting is that there be, in effect, an auction mechanism, you know, with tranches of payments available to people, you know, so many contracts this year, so many contracts next year, building, of course, toward universal adoption, but that people will say, well, what extra does it cost to, I misspeak about your mechanism, although I can imagine a different one. Yours just starts out, you've assumed a price the first time, but you've assumed a limited number of people, and so a number of people get that the first year, and then your mechanism, your ratchet mechanism, chips in such that if, in fact, people came in with lower prices, it'll go down year by year as you take the next year's tranche. And each year's tranche, remember, being a set of 20-year contracts, so that the overall spend is building up substantially over time. To me, it would be more to the point to bid kind of what your adder would be, you know, do it as a procurement, really, what your adder would be to provide this service. And, you know, given that you're also going to get other values out of it, and let the customer be the judge of the other values. In either case, there's intended to be a market adjustment here, not just a complete blank sheet estimation.
Yeah, that's correct, Baird. And the tranches, by the way, they adjust every quarter. So it's 3-month tranches. So you know, if the market price moves away from where the dispatchability adder is set, people don't need to wait around for a year. They just need to wait around for 3 months, and then an adjustment will happen. And that adjustment can be up or down, depending on market response. So you essentially have the streamlined effectiveness of a feed-in tariff with the market responsiveness of an auction without having the horrific backbreaking costs, parasitic costs associated with an auction. Auction processes do not work for commercial scale projects. You know, they're fine for, you know, utility scale, really large utility scale projects. But once you get down into the kind of 1 megawatt or, you know, maybe 3 megawatts and below market space, the cost of participating in an auction alone is over $100,000, and you break the backs of parties who actually want to participate and come to the market. They just don't have the wherewithal to participate in an auction where there's high likelihood of losing, and that means all that money just went up in flames that you spent just to participate in a complex auction process. So the feed-in tariff approach and the dispatchability adder approach just eliminates all that parasitic bullshit cost. And going to what the other gentleman was asking about, there are empirical approaches to pricing out the OPEX and CAPEX of a battery system. Any developer of that's going to deploy a battery looks, you know, very carefully at that, and has, you know, should have a very sophisticated model for how that battery is going to be operated. And here's the reality is, if let's just talk about lithium-ion technology because it's the most pervasive by far. Generally speaking, you're going to have a limit, what I'll call a dead zone, in terms of how much of the state of charge you're able to actually utilize on an everyday basis. So typically, your dead zone at the bottom of the battery is about 20%. And what that means is that if you operate your battery below the 20% threshold state of charge, then you're going to void your warranty. And nobody's going to do that, right, because they ultimately want the supplier of the battery to make sure that they will warrant, you know, that battery for the defined term of its useful life, which, as I said before, is somewhere between 10 and 15 years. So the you basically have this dead zone that's sitting there, and on an everyday basis, and by the way, under the dispatchability adder, the anticipation is that the capacity will be utilized daily. It'll be utilized for whatever the off-taker wants to use it for. The off-taker in this case is a utility or a community choice aggregator, and they're a load-serving entity, and they can choose to take that energy whenever they want. At least at the coming out of the starting gates, the anticipation is that the dispatchability adder, you know, the contracted capacity, energy capacity under the dispatchability adder will be taken on a daily basis for load shifting, right? It basically be taking down the head of the duck here in California, right? The duck curve, you take down the head of the duck. That's when the energy is the most expensive. It's when it's the dirtiest. It's like every negative thing you could think about energy. It's the worst. It's as bad as it gets, right? And that head of the duck happens in the kind of 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. time frame. So, you know, their sun's not really shining super bright at that time of the, you know, that time of the day or that time of the night. So, you know, the only energy you're going to be able to deliver under the, you know, at the head of the duck from those, from that solar resource, let's just say it's a solar resource, is energy that's been stored, right? And so that comes out during that head of the duck through essentially a load shifting process. But you're only going to load shift to the point that you're only going to offer up your dispatchable energy capacity services to the point that you're down to that 20% state of charge on your battery on a normal everyday basis. But if the grid goes down, even if it goes down right at sunset, right, you have a certain amount of state of charge that's going to be north of 20%, right? You're going to have everything you had saved up, planning to deliver under that head of the duck, right, in that 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. time frame. You're going to have all of that, plus you're going to have the 20%. So what I anticipate, what the Clean Coalition anticipates, is that battery suppliers are going to become open to the idea of allowing the battery operator to dip into that 20% reserve on the bottom and utilize that in the case of a grid outage, at least for the very first day. Because if you have a grid outage, you're no longer going to be delivering under your normal, you know, DEX services to do load shifting. So the next day you can charge up that battery as much as you want, and you have all of that capacity available for your resilience needs, because you're no longer on the hook to deliver them under your normal DEX contract or your dispatchability adder contract. But I think just to kind of put a, you know, kind of sum it up, the ability to understand what your costs are for deploying that battery, deploying and operating that battery, those are very well known. Right, there's very sophisticated model that any developer that's deploying a microgrid, you know, has, you know, utilizes.
And I'd like to open this up to anybody else who might have questions right now. So anybody that would like to chime in, go ahead.
Yeah, sure. This is Lori Schell. Hi, Craig. Question, and we're talking about valuing, measuring resilience. When you're I'm a little confused in your initial description of valuing resilience. You used three terms, not quite interchangeably, but that I view as being very distinct. You know, you said that you prefer a cost of service methodology, which in rate making terms is very specific, and, you know, historical accounting costs, yada, yada. Then you said that it's a market-based approach, which, you know, again, market-based rate making is very distinct from cost of service rate making. And then you said that you could translate the cost of service into a feed-in tariff mechanism, which, again, I see as a very distinct, you know, third type of rate making, if you will. So I'm a little confused because you, at least as I understood it, you kind of conflated them to, you know, all in the same discussion, and I see them as being very distinct rate-making mechanisms. I wonder if you can help me clarify that or clarify what you meant.
Sure. Yeah, so, you know, cost of service is essentially taking a look at the cost to deploy some type of solution and putting a fair, you know, rate of return on top of it, right, and then determining mm-hmm. how that rate's going to be set.
Right.
So that's cost of service. Market approach is where you essentially, you know, see what at what price, you know, the market's going to respond.
Right.
And the
competition.
Yeah, through competition. And so, you know, presumably if you do your cost of service analysis correctly, then you have come up with the market rate. So those two things should be similar. Now, one would argue, and I have a feeling you would argue, that the cost of service is an administrative exercise, and your chance of getting that exactly right is low, and so, you know, it's a proxy for the market rate, right? It's the best that an administrator can do, and I'd agree with that statement. So what you can do is you can set that, you do your cost of service administrative pricing, you know, process, come up with your best guess at what the market price is, you put that into a feed-in tariff, and you attach a market responsive pricing mechanism to the feed-in tariff. So the very first tranche is going to be priced low, right, below where the market probably is. So you're not going to get a whole lot of participation at that very first tranche. But luckily, the first tranche only lasts for 3 months, and you roll into the second tranche. And the second tranche, if you didn't get the right market response you were hoping for, then you ratchet the price up. And you basically, you approach your pricing adjustment such that you will hit the price where the market is responding, and then at some point you will get to the point where you have an over response and you'll ratchet the prices, you know, down when that happens. So the beautiful thing about a feed-in tariff is that you take a cost of service starting point, maybe you reduce it a little bit from where you think the cost of service really is, just to make sure that you're not going to overpay for anything. Because I know that, you know, kind of people who claim to be market purists get kind of upset about cost of service approaches. But that's how the whole utility industry is priced, by the way. And so the feed-in tariff allows you to have the benefits of a cost of service starting point without putting everybody through the very wasteful process of a auction process, and then you put a market responsive pricing mechanism on it to essentially make sure that you track the market as changes may occur. For example, if depending on what Trump tweets on any given moment, you don't know whether there's tax benefits or not, right? So you know, as those things come and go, you can decide, or you know, developers can determine what their, you know, what their costs are and whether they can make the new feed-in tariff price work for their economics or not, right? And if it does work, then they can participate, and if it doesn't work, then they will sit it out. And they will see where the market price goes as the market responsive pricing mechanism does its thing to keep everything tracked to where the market will essentially clear the tranche.
So
go ahead, Lauren.
Yeah, just so when you I think that clarifies it. So the cost of service, you know, administrative exercise is purely a starting point. So it's really a market adjusted feed-in tariff.
Yes.
Okay.
And I don't like to use that term because it's too close to REMAT, you know, the Renewable Energy Market Adjusting Tariff mechanism in California, which was a total failure. But that was a failure because they made the tranches tiny, and you had to have five people sitting in queue in order for there to ever be a price adjustment. They had some super poison pill, landmines in that design, which the Clean Coalition argued very heavily against having those landmines in there. But nonetheless, they the sausage making process in California came out with a market mechanism that was a total failure and was predictably a total failure.
The cost of service is, it's not really a cost of service methodology. It's a cost of service starting point, and then it really rolls into a market adjusted feed-in tariff.
Yes, this is Baird.
And let me say, I think it's an interesting rolling auction, if you want to call it that, although I know Craig doesn't like the idea of auctions. I sort of disagree with his estimation of the cost of participating, in the sense that the RTOs are buying services on an auction basis all the time, and the cost of participating is nothing like that. If it's an auction for a particular facility, I guess it could get
those auctions you're talking about. Let me finish.
I mean, what the bigger point is that we have very strong feelings that services should be disaggregated. That there are a lot of different services that the grid operator needs in addition to energy, and energy at particular times and particular ways may be worth more than other times. So our view of this is that what you're trying to do, and there we can talk about the ways, and maybe Craig's way is the way, but we're trying to talk about what's the marginal additional payment you have to make to someone to get them, along with the fact that they're getting their own cheaper energy and their own other services that that they're installing things for. They may have market revenues for other services that they're providing. What's the marginal additional cost that somebody needs to go ahead and make this a full-scale microgrid and be able to provide the resiliency services as well? And I guess I'm still a little confused about who's paying to whom. It sounds like it's like, never mind. I mean, it's either the utility or the community choice aggregator, I guess. So in any event, it's the mothership. And they're paying on everybody's behalf.
Or it's the facility. I mean, basically, to get the resilience, you need to reserve a certain capacity in the battery, right? You need to determine what you're going to need to ride through on the worst weather day. If you're talking about solar, like the worst solar weather day of the year or of the century, right? And then determine how much battery capacity you're going to need to reserve. And that battery capacity has a real cost to it. There's a CapEx and OpEx.
Well, I understand. I mean, I guess, I think that's more complicated too, especially, I mean, what you're suggesting probably makes as much sense in California as any place. Hawaii was concerned that they have months without sun sometimes, and they were convinced they needed backup diesel no matter what. On the East Coast, where there's heating loads, people think that cogeneration is still an efficient idea that they ought to be doing behind the meter, and there's gas infrastructure that's much more resilient than the electric infrastructure. So there are a lot of different scenarios, and I guess the question is, I mean, if it's an individual choice for a customer, that's customers can always go decide whatever's worth to them is worth to them and install it. So the question is, what's the utility or the market maker or the person that's in a position to make a public benefit payment based on public benefit charges willing to pay for this additional service of being resilient over some period of time?
Yeah, I agree, and that boils down to the cost of the equipment that needs to be reserved for that purpose. And so,
okay, let me just break in here for a minute. I'd like to have anybody. We only have 5 minutes left. Are there any other questions besides the ones that have already been asked? Anybody else want to join in here? Okay. Doesn't seem like anything urgent, so go ahead, Craig.
We've gotten everybody's eyes glazed over.
Well, I apologize.
Well, they're still on. They're still listening, so that's a good sign. I don't think you scared too many people.
You know, this stuff is complicated, and it's hard to make it full even with when you have slides. But you know, obviously, you know, exponentially difficult when you're just talking about it over a phone conversation. But you know, the key is really to determine how much reserve of these facilities you need of you know, battery capacity is the easiest thing to think about. And if you're going to need 100 kilowatt hours of battery capacity in order to ride through your worst weather day, then that 100 kilowatt hours needs to be sitting there all the time. And so that has a certain cost, right? And it's actually, you know, I'd say fairly straightforward to calculate for somebody who is in the business of deploying batteries, right? It's easy for them to calculate. So they can determine whether the dispatchability adder is at a price level that makes sense for them. And if it is, then they participate. If it isn't, then they don't. And when that dispatchability adder, you know, adjusts to a price level that does make sense to them, then that's when they jump in and they participate. If there's a whole bunch of people that could participate before them, maybe they will never get an opportunity to participate because the price will never hit the level where that particular player could deploy the battery. I will say that some of this will be covered on a webinar that I'm going to be giving tomorrow on the Goleta Load Pocket Community Microgrid, which covers the entire Santa Barbara region and getting renewables-driven resilience to this Goleta Load Pocket. So if folks are interested in this and hearing more, and I will have slides, so it'll be a lot easier to follow some of this. That's happening tomorrow, 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, and you can register just by going to the Clean Coalition website.
Any event, we're all in favor of microgrid tariffs, and we, even though the details need to be worked out, we're encouraging utilities and utility commissions to look at them.
Amen.
Okay. All right. I need to say a couple of things here before we all disappear. We have another conference call on Monday, July 30th, and we'll be talking about what's new and what works in energy finance with Jeff Hinsky, Kalina Robb, and Patrick Morand. Patrick is also doing a webinar in August, on August 6th, Developing Renewable Energy Projects and Opportunity Zones. And also Shalom and a couple other folks, John Walter and Jeff Hintke again, on Solar Saturation Call, Solar Saturation Microgrid Approach on August 7th. On August 5th, we have Developing Renewable Energy Projects and Opportunity Zones, and again, Patrick Moran will be on the call this time. I apologize for the plethora of emails. We had to change services. Some people did not get the emails that we used to be on the old servers, so I've had to try to figure out how to migrate them over. If you're not getting emails for the webinars particularly, and I will send an email to the group about this, please go to my website, mseforum.com/events, and click the opt-in button and opt in, and then you'll be on the list. This new service is fussy about who you can send emails to, which keeps it from ending up in spam folders for those who can get it. And you have to opt in order to get the emails. Most of you should be on the list, but if you're not getting them, please go and opt in, and then you'll start getting them for sure. So anyhow, any last comments here? Anybody? Okay. So we'll go ahead and end it now. Excellent conversation, as usual, Craig and
okay, I'm not sure if this cut off automatically, but here's Craig signing off. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Craig. Bye.